okay, I'm in heels. I was sitting so long. You get my balance. Hi. Hi, I'm Amy Spain Duncan. I am an alcoholic. Thank you all. Thank you, Taryn. Thank you, Debbie, for your hospitality. Todd, Joey, thank you. And all the committee. Todd's thanked everyone. I was going to read from the pamphlet. There was a list, and I thought I could just read each name if we had time. No? Okay. But it does. It takes so much to put these on, and this has been so much fun. This has been a blast. My husband is with me tonight. He usually doesn't, you know, tag along on these things, and we've just had a wonderful time, and you've all been so hospitable and kind and warm, and it's appreciated because, you know, I'm not from here. So, yeah, right? And so I really appreciate all the smiles, all the welcome, all the hospitality that was given. It means the world. My sobriety date is March 6, 2010. Thank you. My ears popped on the airplane. If I start yelling, someone, because I feel like I'm in a fishbowl right now. And there's some important things about that day. What happened? I don't know what happened on March 6th. There was this willingness that hadn't existed before. I had the desire to not drink. What? No. I had the desire not to have consequences from my drinking. I really desired that. I really did. I didn't like that you were so upset. That bothered me a little bit. I didn't like the trouble and, you know, all of those things. My dad used to say, you know, I was always trying to figure out how to do the wrong thing the right way. You know, I just didn't want to be in trouble anymore, mostly. But that day, not only did I have this desire to not live the life I was living, but in this just brief moment came some willingness to put some action behind the desire. And everything changes. Let's see what it was like. I want to say real quick, I know we're thinking people and stuff like that, and COVID has just been crazy. And last week, we lost one of our tapers that does a lot of these. And during COVID, Mike started conferences on Zoom and just started calling all of us and getting us together so that we wouldn't fall apart. And Mike passed last week. I just want to say we stand on the shoulders of giants, you know. Yesterday was my dad's birthday. He died 2 years ago. He died with 30 years of sobriety, and he would have loved this. He loved you guys so much. And I don't see me like you see me. I see me as, you know, I did a lot of drugs. I drank a lot. I kind of twitched. I was skinny. And we don't see ourselves. So people are like, oh, it's so good to see you. And we're like, you know, you're going to speak. And I'm just like, eh, we'll see. But I can see them, and I know how I viewed them and how I respected and loved and followed. See, because we're all here because we followed someone else's lead, and we stand on the shoulders of giants, and what a humbling and amazing thing it is to have heard what they said. Right, Ralph talked about the art of listening. See, I'd heard a lot of things, but I never heard what you said. And finally, you start to hear, and I'm just grateful that I heard men like Mike, and Mike didn't talk a lot, but I heard through his actions, you know, and this committee and the people that give time and hours, and the H&I, I hear you, and I see you, and I thank you, you know, and I think that's important for us. All right, so I was born, and I think only my dad was happy about that. My mom, not so much, because that kind of strapped her to my dad, and well, you know, he He was one of us. And when I was young, I used to hear, you're just like your dad. You're so good in math and you're so smart and all of that. And I think, that's wonderful. But when I was 14 and I was blowing curfew and I was fist fighting anybody that would fight me, I got, you're just like your dad. And it meant something different. It meant something different when they said it that time. And my mom and dad divorced when I was 7 years old. My mom saw the writing on the wall. And my mom was raised in an alcoholic home. My mom's job on Saturday was to make sure that there was a window unlocked in every room. Because my grandfather was a binge drinker. And he was a rager. And in case he caught you in there, you had to have an escape route. That's what my mom grew up in. So when my dad's drinking started really taking off, my dad, she divorced him. You know, she wanted something better and different for me and my baby sister. And I was mad. I wasn't mad at dad. I liked dad. She was the only one that was mad at dad. And really, even at seven, I felt like we should have maybe talked about it a little more. I have this thing that, you know, I expect and I deserve, and I think my opinion matters, and definitely people want to hear it, and it should be considered. And I was not getting the respect that I felt like I needed, you know, in this family. And so it kind of put me at odds with them, which is a shame, because my mom was the one person in this world that would lay down her life for me. See, my perception. It's so weird. I remember my mom would, and to our Al-Anon friends, thank you so much. And I just remember, I just remember that my dad looked like he was having fun, you know? And she was mad. I just always thought, what an angry woman. That's not nice. But we would, she would put us in the back of the station wagon at like 1 a.m., like every good Al-Anon, and we'd go looking for dad, you know. And she would say, you know, Amy, is your dad's motorcycle in the parking lot? And the neon, I can still see it in my little brain, you know, the neon light said the kitten house. And I would think, who doesn't like kittens? It's a very angry woman, you know. I couldn't put it all together, you know, at that age. But anyway, they divorced. And as they divorced, my dad's alcoholism, it's progressive, right? We know that we suffer from a progressive and fatal disease if left untreated, and my dad was just getting started. And so basically my dad, who I adored, was gone. You know, his sobriety date was my 18th birthday. So I started looking for men. I if there was a poster child for like daddy issues, right here. Don't worry, they're all solved now. Everything's better. But up till, you know, a certain point, it was bad. It was bad. It's hard to have friends when you sleep with everyone. And girls get really upset about that. Then they want to fight, and it's just, it's a mess. I tell you, my mom tried to slow me down. She tried to send me to an all-girl parochial school, you know, because I had the hot pants. And those girls said, we don't drink, and we don't smoke, and we don't kiss boys. And I said, neither do I. And that was a lie. I did all of those things. I did all of those things. By the time I was 13, 14 years old, I drank. And I smoked, and I kissed boys. And that double life, you know. So here comes the lying, the dishonesty. And it's so natural, and it's so easy, and it doesn't even require thought. Like, I will just open my mouth, and dishonesty will just pour out. Like, I'm very comfortable in dishonesty. And, because I need to control what you think of me. I need to, you know, I need to write the narrative. It's important that I write the narrative, because if you write the narrative, I'll be the bad guy. And I don't like being the bad guy so much, you know. But at some point, so I am a Gen Xer, born in 71, and girls with ADHD, there weren't fidget spinners, no one cared. We were just bad. Basically, you talk too much, you don't sit still, you forget everything, you're chatty, you're spacey, you know, you're all those things. No one cared. But I internalized that I was bad, that something was wrong with me. And even before the drink, right, so our book talks about even we have to admit, when asked why do you keep repeating this behavior? Why do you keep doing this? That even the alcoholic knows that the excuse is lame, you know, that we don't have an excuse. And I was hearing, why do you do this, Amy, from first grade, before I ever had a drink. People were asking me, why do you do this? Why do you talk in class? And why do you giggle in mass, you know? Because in mass, I don't know, any Catholic, everything's funnier when you're not supposed to laugh and the nuns are like looking. I'm like, God, it was awful. So I was a kid that was always in trouble. And, you know, one of my favorite things about Alcoholics Anonymous is I've never been in trouble here. I've never been in trouble here. Had I been in trouble, I wouldn't have come back, because I've been in trouble since I was 7. And when I found you, that was the first time I hadn't been in trouble. You didn't ask me why. You knew why, you know? So growing up with my mom and my stepdad and my kid sister and just not feeling like, I just miss my dad, and I didn't like my stepdad, and my sister did, and they seemed like a family, and I just felt outside of everything. And mom, my poor mother, just trying to provide me every opportunity, and me just blowing through them, expecting and deserving. You know, I ended up, Richard, you say you moved a lot, right? So I changed high schools 4 times, but we never moved. And my dad's not in the military. I have to change high schools because I can't get along with you. And I sleep with your boyfriend, or I sleep with your girlfriend, or I fight you, or whatever happens, it's usually bad. And my solution is to keep it moving. The book calls it seeking out sorted companionship, and trying to find a place where my unacceptable behavior would be acceptable. And that's what I would do, because I didn't know about amends, and I didn't know about inventory, and I didn't know about responsibility. And honest to God, I didn't know why I did the things I did. It just seemed to happen. And it wasn't, you know, my intention. The world is judging us by our actions. It was never my intention to hurt you or disappoint you or make you mad. It just seemed to follow me wherever I went, no matter how hard I tried. Because what's going to happen is I'm going to take a drink. And I'm going to convince myself that this time will be different, and here's how. Right? And I'm so far from recognizing alcoholism as my issue. My issue is you. It's my mom. It's my absent dad. It's the nuns. It's the school. It's the coach. It's the employer. It's the boyfriend. It's the girlfriend. All my problems are you. I'm so far from recognizing that I'm my problem. That I'm the problem I have. And that took so long, unfortunately. So I ended up changing high schools 4 times. I barely graduated, but I did graduate. And this from a kid who had all that potential, right? God, what a dirty word. I mean, it's like, ugh, why do you even... Because then you expect something of me. And it's important that you don't, for this relationship to work out. I'd be at the bar, and the cowboys would line up, and I'd say, look, cowboy, you can buy me drinks all night long, but I'm going to fast forward. You're going to end up mad, you know? Maybe not tonight, maybe not next week, but sooner or later, you're going to be mad. And they get mad, and then they leave, or you kick them out, or you try to stab them, whatever happens. Whatever happens. I'm just saying it ends. It ends. And I got used to that. I had my first baby at 19. And, man, I want to tell you that I love that kid. My God, I love that kid. We all love our kids, you know. And I wish that that was enough. But alcoholism doesn't care how much I love that kid, and it didn't care how much that kid needed me. It just didn't care. And she was raised by an alcoholic woman, child. You know, probably by the time I was 17, I was putting something in my body every day to feel different than I did. And I got a job at a bar because I think we should all work at bars. They're just, I love that. And I started dating the bouncer because I like to fight. He likes to fight. It was a kind of a fair fight. And we'd get drunk and we would fight. And she had this little Pooh Bear, and she chewed the hair off the top of him, you know, because it's hard for kids when they don't know what's going to happen, you know. God, you know, the warped lives of blameless children. See, when I read that book, that made sense to me. I knew what that meant. I knew what that meant. So I'm dating the bouncer, and I end up pregnant with him. He doesn't want a baby. He takes off real quick. I married his kid brother. So anyway. Listen. I know you think I'm from Kentucky, right? But he wasn't my brother. Does that clear it up? I just want to clear that up. It wasn't my brother, you know. It was his brother, and, you know, it was convenient. And this poor guy, he just didn't know what had happened. I spent 10 years trying to figure out why my mother-in-law didn't like me. I was doing my 4-step in 2010. Of course, my mother-in-law's at the top because she obviously ruined my marriage. And that was... And my sponsor, you know how they do. They look at you just, like, so confused. Like, it's weird. You know, they're like, what? You do not see where you set the ball in motion at all, you know. Like, I gave her beautiful children by all her sons. I meant that. In my heart, I meant that. I was like, Jesus, that poor woman. I have a son, and if something like me came around, oh, God help us all. That was crazy. So anyway, I had, you know, the bouncer's daughter, my daughter, Allie, Alexandra. And then, you know, then I married her uncle. And then we had some kids. So Allie has, like, a sister cousin and a brother cousin. That's a true story. Nothing weird going on over here. See, you guys get that. Other people don't understand that. So I'm married for a year, and I will say, you know, Led Zeppelin filled the chapel. It looked like a Wiccan wedding. Like, he had long hair, and I'm in a big wet white veil, you know. Jesus. And a year into this marriage, he said, I'm taking the girls, and I'm leaving you. See, because what he and I, neither one knew, was what alcoholism was going to do in that home and to me. And I'm a rager, like my grandpa. And when I get drunk, you don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know what's going to happen. But a lot of times, it ended up violently. And I would bust windows, and I would break dishes, and I would fight people in the front yard, and I would fight him, and those two little girls would hide in their bedroom closet. And he was smart enough to say, this isn't, I can't do this, and we're going to leave. That's called frothy emotional appeal. I was 24 years old. I was getting ready to turn 25, and I called my dad, and I said, hey, Dad, I think I got what you got. And Dad said, yeah. And Dad said, why don't you come over? And I knew that Dad had been hanging out with you guys. And I thought, that's good. I thought this is where, like, drunks retired. Like, you know, like, you live this wonder, you know, this life we live in. At some point, you retire from that. And you drink coffee with other retirees. And I thought it was good that Dad had that. And I went over to his house, and my dad told me about you. And he 12-stepped me, you know. And I knew something was different. I don't know for the older folks. My dad had the same phone number for a long time. And that was a big deal, and I don't know why that stuck out to me, but I remembered that because I used to have to call my grandma to see if she had seen my dad or if my dad had come by. And whatever number Dad had given you, you know, was disconnected when you, you know, would call. And my dad had the same phone number since he had retired into AA. And so I knew things were different because my dad was available all of a sudden, and he had never been available, you know, and since he had met you, he was available. And so I was impressed with you guys, because, you know, he was available. And my dad took me to my first AA meeting, and, you know, oh, they're like ninjas. I met a woman there that night, and I thought, serendipity. But really, my dad had called her and been like, my daughter's coming to the meeting. Can you meet us there? You know how we do. And I met Beth that night, and Beth has forever and still continues to be part of my life today. And Beth had gotten sober at 19 years old, and I thought, poor Beth. And Beth was a real alcoholic, and she didn't know anything about the side dishes and all the things that I do when I get drunk. And I thought, oh, that's so sweet. How cute. That's cute. And so Beth taught me a lot, and I taught Beth a lot. And I went to a lot of meetings, and I wasn't in trouble, and I loved being with you guys. And I did steps 1, 2, and 3 off the wall. Right off the wall. And then quickly moved to step 12 to help people. And I did that for about 3 years. And he and I had 2 more kids, the cousins, right? And then we bought a bigger house. And I had what I call fellowship sobriety, right? But then, you know, I got busy because, you know, that's what happens, right? We get busy. And I started cutting back on my meetings because it really wasn't fair to, like, not be home with the kids. There's a lot going on there, and they need me, and I'm sober so I can do this. And so I really don't have time for as many meetings. But then something came up, and I missed that meeting. And I tried to go. We had moved about 45 minutes from where I'd gotten sober. And I tried some of those meetings, but they weren't my people, and they did things different, and they didn't read the same. So I really couldn't go to those meetings. You see what's happening? I'm fading out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you have fellowship sobriety and you stop going to the fellowship. But I had learned enough from you that I knew that I shouldn't drink. Maybe not that I couldn't drink, but that probably I shouldn't drink. At least not the way I had been drinking. But I like God, and God made weed. And so instead of being a violent, raging biker chick, I reinvented myself, and I bought a guitar, and I planted a garden. We're going to be hippies. Hippies don't fight, right? And I'm just, that's what we're going to do. I listened to a lot of Joni Mitchell, and me and the kids colored, and we made tie-dyes, and I grew green beans. And I smoked weed until I got really thirsty when I smoke weed. And I decided that I was going to drink, you know, a beer, but only at home. Only at home. Only two, maybe three. All right. And you know where that goes. See, when I came to you the first in 95, and I had the 3 years of sobriety, I never read this. I didn't read that. I didn't know what was in there. I mean, I would hear people say, like, the boo book says, and I'd be like, oh, well, there. I don't. It's like the Cliff Notes. I have to read it because people had kind of told me what it said, and I was like, that's good. I like that. I like what you said there. So the thing is with alcoholism is how patient it is. And I love the analogy of the frog and the boiling water. And Beth used to say, you're the last one to know you're knee-deep in shit. Your friends smelt that a long time ago. And there I stood, you know, not recognizing that I was moving, that alcoholism was closing its grips. And I was just ever so slightly and ever so subtly. And I hadn't read the book, and so I didn't really recognize what was happening. But you know what was happening, right? By the time I was 35, he and I were divorced. It's worse than ever. The rage is back. The fighting. I'm disappearing. I'm leaving for days, and I can't stand him. I mean, I can't stand anybody. And the world opened up, and it swallowed me whole. Within 8 months of that separation. See, when you're married, it's like, you know, and there's kids, and there's things to do, and there's baths to give, and there's homework, and there's always laundry. God, the laundry. And the dishes, and it kind of tethers you to something. You know, but after the divorce, it was just me and the bottle. And I can't work anymore. That was my wino stage. I really did not want to fall into the abyss of the darkness. So I decided to be a wino. I thought divorcees drink wine. And now I was a divorcee. And wine is, oh my God, the hangovers. And this is how crazy we are. So I'm living alone. This is, you know, while I was still paying rent. I had this place. I was living alone, and I was drinking Zinfandel every night. And it was time to take the garbage out. And I remember picking up the garbage bag, and it was all wine bottles. And I thought, what will the garbage man think? So I went to the freezer and, like, put some frozen dinners in there. Some that, you know, at least they would know I am eating. Like, why? I don't understand why that was important to me, but I didn't want anyone to worry. Like the garbage man. So, some Marie Callender's in there, you know, strategically placed so they would know that I don't just drink, I eat too. That's bad. But I can't pay rent because I can't go to work. And and then, you know, you live in your car for a while, and that's okay because you're going to get it together, and you're just having some bad luck, and you're going to get a job. And my disease does this fun thing with me where it tells me that Monday, everything's going to be different. On Monday, we're going to, you know, take a shower. We're going to start there. We're going to get a job, and then we're going to save up some money. Then we'll get a new place to live. And then we'll see the kids. We're going to do that. We're going to do it Monday. But in the meantime, while we wait for Monday, they towed the car. That was a bad day. When you live in your car and they tow your car, that's like, I mean, for an alcohol, like, I heard a speaker in Nashville say one time, you know, I lived in my car and a friend asked if he could stay with me. So, alcoholics, like, you're not homeless if you have a car. But when they take the car, it's kind of like, ew. I really am kind of bordering on homeless right now. It was a bad day. Everything I owned was in there. I was like, well, shit. Nothing to do then but just take a drink, right? March 6, 2010, my dad picked me up off a street corner. Asked me if he could take me to detox, to a homeless shelter. It was a non-medical detox. If it was a homeless shelter, I mean, if you started seizing, they would call an ambulance. So there were like sober people that kind of kept an eye on you, but that was all there was for me. God, I didn't want to go. I had already gone twice before. Right, so I'd gone to this homeless shelter, and I was like, this is for people really bad off. I hate to take up a bed, because Monday, everything's going to turn around for me. I'm a very gracious person. I don't want to take up the space that someone else would probably need, you know. I mean, Monday I'll be fine. So I didn't stay. And then the next time I went, it was so funny. They said, you know, this is a 6 to 9 month program here at the homeless shelter. You can't have a car. You can't have a phone. You can't have a job while you complete this program. And I was like, oh, that's unfortunate. Because Monday, I didn't have a car. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have a job. But Monday, you know. And Dad said, you know, let me take you there one more time. And I want you to know that, and I'm not proud of this, but I cussed my daddy so bad. I told him about all those men he had helped, Alcoholics Anonymous, how he wouldn't help me, and how he had left me, how he didn't care about me, and he only cared about you, and he only cared about them. And I hurt him. I hurt him so bad that day. I won. He said, why don't we? Well, what he told me was, Amy, my sponsor, says you should go to detox, you know. And then maybe after that you could stay with me and, we could try to get sober, you know, and I'll give you a place to stay. But first you got to go to detox, honey, because you've unleashed the beast and you got to, you know, have some time. You're in a spree and you got to stop for a minute and then you could come stay with me. And I called him everything but Dad that day, and I heard him, and he said, okay, let's just go to my house. We'll just do that. And as he was getting out of the car, he said, why don't you call Beth though? And see what she says to you. And he went on inside, and something happened. Like, when Dad got out, this peace came over me. And I went inside, and I said, take me right now, or I'll change my mind. And my dad drove me to that homeless shelter, and he said, please, Amy, let those women help you, because you're going to die. And I went in, and I sat in that intake chair where they, you know, ask you all the questions and stuff. And I thought it was cute, because they were like, honey, where's your stuff? And I thought, stuff. I have this lighter in case you have a cigarette, and no stuff. I thought it was weird that people would come in there with stuff. I'm like, quitters. I'm gonna ride it till the wheels fall off, you know, like no stuff. They were so nice to me there, and they put me in bed 9. That was my bed, and the woman next to me was really sick, and these women in this homeless shelter, you know, and we would clean up after each other, and we'd bring soup to the one that was sick, and we would run baths and put the really sick women in the tub and let them soak and then get them out, put them back to bed. And I'd never seen that before, you know. And in there, they make you read the book. Okay? And I just want you to know how everything changes. So on March 6th, I hadn't wanted to drink for years. For years. I hated every drink I took. I couldn't stand me and I couldn't stand you, and I missed my kids. But that day, like, there was some willingness to put some action. The gift of desperation. The gift of desperation. And I did that. And then I'm in this homeless shelter. And hi, thank you. So pretty. I was 39 years old and I was living in a homeless shelter with 200 women, and I was as happy as I could be. I was so happy. I smiled ear to ear, and there's a song that came out that year that said, it was a praise and worship song, and it was like, if you never do anything else for me, you've done enough. And I remember singing that, like at 4 months sober and meaning that. Like, if I never leave this homeless shelter, if I never get a car, if I never get to see the kids, this is enough, because I knew joy and I knew gratitude and I knew friendship and I knew sobriety. And I was so excited, and that's all I ever needed and that's all I ever wanted. And it was fine. If you never do anything else for me, you don't know. And it's true that they say put down on a list everything you want, you know, and God's going to make you embarrassed about your list, because that's all I wanted. Yeah, I was happy. I was as happy as I could be. Beth wasn't going to sponsor me this rip. She was sponsoring her my sister. My sister had been sober for a little while, and Beth was sponsoring my sister. And so I got this other lady to be, and I had been on the streets a long time, and I had become what the book describes as dangerously antisocial, and I mean that in the literal sense. My husband's here with me. He was reminding me today about the time I tried to set the house on fire while he was in it. It wasn't a house. It wasn't our house. It was a rooming house where we were staying. And he's like, remember that time you tried to set the entire building on fire to kill me? And I'm like, you had it coming. But things were crazy, you know, they were crazy, and that's what I'd come with. So when I got to you, I was full of spit and piss and anger and desperation, you know, and you weren't mad at me, and once again, I wasn't in trouble, and I appreciate that. But I got a sponsor I could hear. Clancy talks about the Teflon that covers the alcoholic, and good words come and they bounce right off. And Rhonda, I could hear. She could pierce through the Teflon, and I could hear what she's saying. And she, back in Louisville, we call it raw and uncut. And that's how she came, and I needed it, and she was hard, and she delivered that information hard. And this book came alive, and I understood every word in it, and I would open it up to there's a solution, and tears would fall from my eyes. What good news. What good news. There is a solution. What good news. And we started doing the steps. And I told you a little bit about my 4-step. And, you know, how insane I am. And poor Rhonda. And you know, the other thing was I had 145 harms. And, well, it's, you know, she said, you're not that important. Take these back. You didn't hurt these many people. I had, like, my cousin, because I wasn't at her son's birthday, and she was like, did they have the party? I'm like, yeah. She's like, they're so glad you weren't there. They come off the list. You didn't harm them. They're very excited. They didn't want you there. That's not a harm. I was a prostitute, and I had, you know, Trix and John's on there, and she's like, take them off the list. She said, fair exchange ain't robbery. I needed direction. Do you see what I'm saying? I needed good sponsorship. And then this thing happens. So people talk about five, right? And the broad highway and the pink cloud and all this. I didn't get that. When I saw myself as I actually was, that it was me. It was this misuse of these instincts. And it was my fears and my insecurities and my resentments that drove me. It was my need for approval and my social instinct and my sex instinct and my fame. And it was all me in this misuse of instincts and the demands that I placed on the world and its people. When I saw that, when she broke that down for me, it drove me to my knees. Because if this is me, this is it. There's a reason 6 and 7 follow 5. And in our original manuscript, it says that we humbly on our knees ask our Creator. And I want you to know that I went back to that homeless shelter and I got on my knees in that bathroom and I begged my Creator in this desperation, in this earnest desire, when I earnestly sought Him, right? I needed God right then. I didn't know if it was real. I didn't know if it would make sense. And I didn't know if it worked for me, right? But if you're real and you care and you would do this for me, you either kill me or you change me. But don't let this woman, don't let me hurt anybody else. Don't let me hurt my kids. Why did you allow this? You know, I should have been struck from the earth. Like, why did you allow this? Like, change me or let me die. And that was my prayer. And I started singing that 7-step prayer over and over and over again. And I was crying and sobbing and my tears covered this bathroom. And suddenly, he came. It came. Energy came. And it took the breath out of my body and something happened. And I was terrified. Bill had a white light and it was like a cool mountain breeze. It was not my experience. I was scared to death and frozen in fear, and something was pulled up out of me. A darkness that had attached itself to my soul was being ripped out of me, and I couldn't move and I couldn't get up, and then it was over. And as I got up out of the bathroom and I reached for the door, I heard a voice say, "Tell someone what I did." So I went to the cafeteria to tell Lauren Pepper what had happened. Because I was like, that was weird. That was weird. And it was years later. It was years later, and me and my dad and Miss Pearl, and we're on an airplane. We're taking off from Louisville, and we're flying to Alaska, where I get to meet Tom I. Yeah, and Jimmy Dean and Bo, and the airplane's taking off, and I'm looking out the window, and I hear that voice say, "Tell somebody what I did." And that's why I'm your speaker tonight, to tell you what God did. For a wretch like me. So the steps work. And so I did that. And then I ran around and I did 8 and 9. Those weren't hard. After that experience on 6 and 7, I was willing to do whatever. And I want to tell you this, though, with good sponsorship. So I went to my kids, those beautiful children. My oldest daughter was 19 by then. And my two babies, the cousins, were getting ready to go into adolescence. Let me tell you about that. So I'm new sober, and they're new into adolescence. So we're like that Volvo commercial, like they lived. That's what that looked like, right? And I think it's important, too, to talk about early sobriety. Because I was nuts. I am nuts. It's not like I got sober and God touched my life and then I made amends and now I speak at conferences. That's not what happened. Like, at 5 years sober, I kicked in my neighbor's door, literally, and threatened to kill everyone in the house. I walked back home, and my husband was mowing the grass, and he just kind of let go of the lawnmower and went over, and he was like, "I see you've met my wife." He said, the thing is with her, I don't know what she's going to do either. So, but she meant that. She meant that shit. So that, you know, when you're dangerously antisocial, when you're coming from this place in life where you survive by being the biggest and the loudest and the meanest, right? My character defects are intimidation and bullying, right? And when backed against the wall or my instincts are affected or I get in a place of fear, my fight or flight has no flight. I'm squaring off. And I don't roll up like an armadillo and hide under a bush. I get real big like a grizzly bear. And that's supposed to scare you so that you don't harm me and you don't harm the people I love. And that's how I protect. And that's how I live. And that's hard to let go of. Because who's going to protect me if I don't? Who's going to protect my kids if I don't? Right? See, faith is good as far as it goes. And God relieved me of my alcoholism. That's amazing. But he's not going to take care of all these things, right? The first 3 years of my sobriety, my home group, God love my home group, Lambton, they would tell the newcomer, don't go, she'll 12 stomp you. So our 12 and 12 talks about the only way you can get an alcoholic to be like selfless and giving is if his very life depends on it. So I was doing the 12-step work, but I was mad about it. I was like, look, I don't want to be here either. I'm really just trying to save my own ass. They said I need to do this. I don't want to hurt my kids anymore. Read the prayers. You know, and the girls would be like, well, I don't know what my relationship with God. I'm like, I didn't ask. We're not having a theological discussion. I gave you some action. Do the action. That's all you do. You know, do you want to live? You want to die? The book tells me on to the next one. On to the next one. You know. So it's bad. It's embarrassing. Rhonda got drunk when I was 3 years sober. The one who had sponsored Mary, and this beautiful woman, Delinda. I'd been talking with her and working with her because she was soft and she was nice and she was sweet. And I thought, that's kind of cool that you can be gentle and stuff, a gentle woman. I thought that was interesting. And I liked her and she was funny, and her son was killed. And so we were doing what AA does, right? We were showing up. We were showing up, and we were bringing casseroles, and we were taking her to meetings, and we were checking on her, and I watched her do this whole thing, and I said to her, you know, if you know who or how, like, you know, I got people, you know, like, we can make this right. And I was only 3 years sober, yeah. And she said, oh, honey, we're not going to do that. And I was like, oh, well, what's the plan? You know? And she said, we're gonna pray for them, and we're going to bury my son. And I thought, wow. Wow. I need what she has. And so Miss Delinda became my sponsor. But so the first conversation, you know, we had as we were doing this, she said, honey, why are you yelling at everyone? So they can hear the message I heard. You know. She said, honey, the truth doesn't have to be yelled. You just say it, and it just stands there all by itself. And I was like, oh, interesting. And then she started saying weird words like self-care. And I was like, what? And she was like, how many meetings are you going to? I'm like, you know, because she would call, what are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing this. I'm picking up Sally, and then we're going to go get Sue, and I've got to hear her force them. And then I'm going to chair a meeting, and then afterwards I'm going to join this committee, and I got this thing I got to do, da, 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 da. And she was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you mean, what am I doing? Action and more action. Faith without works is dead. That's what I'm doing. And she said the most amazing thing to me. She said, sweetheart, grace is not earned. it is given. See, I was trying to earn this life, this freedom from alcohol. I thought if I put away one more chair, and if I sponsor one more woman, and if I go to one more meeting, if I do one more thing, then maybe I'll be worthy of this amazing gift that was given to me for free. As I didn't know how to accept grace. I stayed sober, though. You'll stay sober trying to earn grace. Stay real. But you'll also be exhausted and kick in your neighbor's door. It's a whole thing. It's a trade-off. So after that deal at 5 years sober, I said, what's wrong with me? Why do I keep doing this, you know? I mean, it's been a few years since I put my hands on my husband because I am a spouse abuser. I'm a child abuser. I'm violent. And I'm aggressive. And I pushed him as hard as I could. And I... But after the deal with the neighbors, I called my sponsor after. You don't ever call before because, you know, they're gonna try to... Sponsors are kind of closed-minded about situations. So you need to kind of handle it and then let them know how it went down. And so I called Delinda and I told her what happened. She was like, you're going to jail. I'm like, nah. They're not calling the police. She's like, yeah, that's called terroristic threat. And then, you know, there's like an... I'm like, eh, we'll see. I didn't go to jail. I didn't burn their house down either. They did move. But she said, Amy, are you ready to do all the steps? And I said, what do you mean all the steps? I take women through the steps. I do all the steps. She said, the second half of 11... See, if in our 12 and 12, again, always in the literature, you know, it talks about all the reasons we avoid step 11. Oh, I'm no good at it. I can't sit still. I'm going to leave it to the people more, you know, that understand. They can tell me about it. And that's what I did. And I was really good at prayer. But I told you about that ADHD, and I told you about that violent, rageful, insane mind. And so to be still, oh, God, that's like painful. You know? And she said, we saw through prayer and meditation. And I meditate. I meditate when I drive. I meditate when I do the dishes. So it's like, no distractions. You're still with Source, with sunlight, with your Creator. Right? And so I started with like a 3-minute guided YouTube meditation. That was so painful. And then I found these that you can play as you go to sleep. Ugh, love that. Like, you know, fall asleep meditations. I love those. Those are great. Yes, I did meditate while I was sleeping. It counts. And I started exploring meditation, and I want you to know that, you know, 5 years sober, new things started happening. So, you know, just getting through the steps was wild. And then, you know, step 3, stop yelling at people. And, you know, in 3rd year, I lowered my voice and I stopped trying to earn grace. And then at my 5th year, I started exploring meditation and how that grew and changed. And that's also the year I started doing these conferences, and my dad would go with me everywhere. And man, we had a good time. And in 2019, he died. And we buried him on a Wednesday. And that Thursday, I left to drive to Tybee Island and for the Georgia State Convention. And people were like, Amy, you can call the convention. And people understand, you know, you just bury your dad and you don't have to go. And I remember just saying, where would I be if I wasn't with you? Of course I'm going. This is where, this is, if I'm not with you, I'm in a bottle. There's not a lot of room there to play. And And so we just keep doing this. And yesterday was his birthday. I know he's with us in spirit, and he loved you all so much. So that was neat. I quit jobs. I didn't quit jobs. I cussed people out and then quit jobs. I'm just going to, full disclosure. And then I recently, this year or last year, took a new job, high performance, kind of high demand job, and I'm the director of nursing. That sounds fancy, right? I went back to school. You can go back to school. So I went back to school, and I got a bachelor's degree, and I ended up becoming director of nursing. Thank you, and this thing, and anyway, I cussed my boss out. It was a long story, but anyway, it's the best job I ever had. And the owners called me. Yeah. And my husband's like, please don't cuss them out. Please don't cuss them out. Please don't cuss them out. And they said, Amy, you know, we want the best. And you're the best. But we need you at your best. And 10 years sober, I started going to therapy. I needed outside help with these rage issues and some of this post-traumatic stress, because when you're a woman and you live on the streets, sometimes, you know, things happen and you think you're okay and you're not, you know? So every year, every few years in this wonderful, amazing journey of sobriety and growth and development, I get to add to and learn more and rediscover, right? What does Sandy say? He says we uncover. Yeah, discover. And it doesn't stop. So if you're new, buckle up, Buttercup. Fourth dimension. And if you've got some years and you're like, you know, it's AA, it's where we retired and we're drinking a coffee. You know, I invite you to do the work. Oh, and I wanted to share with you the secret. See, I know where the portal is for the fourth dimension. It's hidden in service. Yeah. Tim Hyland told me a long time ago that if you take care of God's kids, God will take care of you. And that's what we're here to do. See, the whole point, if you read the book, is to fit ourselves for maximum service. On Wednesday nights, I do an H&I commitment, you know, at a women's facility. And it's awesome because they call you up and they're like, hey, Amy, you know, they're letting people come back in. Will you come in and do a back to basics or a 12-step or a big book with these women? They only get like this much AA a week and, you know, they're incarcerated and they really need it. And will you come in? I was like, oh, I'm busy. I'm important things. And... But what comes out of your mouth is, yeah, absolutely. And once again, proving I don't know what's best for me. Wednesday nights are my favorite night of the week. I mean, this is fun, but I can't wait to get back to the ladies Wednesday night, you know. My home group doesn't care that I do this. They want to know if I'll be there on Thursday to put the chairs up. So, you know, that's where the magic is. The magic's in the middle. The magic's in the service. That's where the portal's hidden. So thank you for experiencing this with me this weekend. Thank you again for inviting me. I love you all.